This TFMR podcast is brought to you by your friends at JM Bullion. Visit jmbullion.com for all your gold and silver bullion needs. Happy Thursday out there to everybody at TFMR and the greater internet. Hey, it is your Thursday conversation for July 22nd. I'm actually recording this, though, on Wednesday, July 21st. With our old friend Alistair McLeod, who many of you know is head of research at Gold Money and is a very valuable contributor in the precious metals community. Of course, you always want to keep Gold Money in mind whenever you're in the market for physical metal or a place to store it. And another always a great reason to visit their site is to look for anything that Alistair has written in his role as head of research. He actually has been my go-to guy and a go-to guy for many of you regarding Basel III and these changes that are that were begun to be implemented in Europe on June 28th and then the UK banks and how that impacts the LBMA on January 1st of next year. We had this, what kind of felt like a sucker punch about 10 or 12 days ago from the PRA within the UK regarding the LBMA back late Friday, whatever that day was, the 12th of July. Alistair was quick to assess the situation, put out an article where that link is on this page if you really want to understand what's going on. But I thought would be better, having after Alistair's had some time to ponder all this, is to get him on here and have him explain it to you. So anyway, Alistair, that's the point of today's call. Thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it.
That's very much my pleasure, Craig.
Did I do a good job of explaining your job and Gold Money?
Brilliant as usual.
Okay. Again, hey, if you want to keep this kind of information in front of you, make sure you keep Gold Money in mind, goldmoney.com. Okay. They are a great source started by Mr. Turk so many years ago, and we value Mr. Turk as well. So goldmoney.com should always be on your radar whenever you're looking to purchase physical precious metal or looking for a place to store it. Alistair, let's start with, the main point that the LBMA was trumpeting as a victory, and that's this ability to still settle trades in London, because that appears to be like really the only major victory. Let's start there. Tell everybody about that part.
Yes, certainly. I mean, your listeners may recall that, about 6 weeks ago, 2 months ago, however long ago it was, the LBMA wrote to the PRA, the mm-hmm. Prudential Regulatory Association, complaining about the treatment of gold under the proposed Basel III rules. And I mean, quite honestly, I found the whole thing very misleading because they were talking about unallocated gold as if it was physical gold, mm-hmm. which is not. I mean, I'd ask the question, if you've got the equivalent of over 8,000 tons of unallocated gold knocking around London, where is it being stored? The answer is it's not. I mean, unless you've actually bought unallocated gold and you're going to turn it into physical gold, which means as a follow-up transaction, actually detailing the size and the purity of the bars to be delivered to you, then this is not gold. It is paper. It is derivative. And not only that, but it's fully recognized by the Bank of International Settlements that that is what forward transactions in gold outside a normal settlements cycle represent. They are derivatives, and they even list them in their statistics as derivatives.
Yep.
So we knew from the start that the LBMA was going to have a real problem with this. I must say, you know, as someone who knows a little bit about the gold market and a little bit about, you know, the regulatory scene for banks, though I must admit I haven't been regulated for a long time, so I'm relying on past experience. It was clear to me that this was going to be a huge, great problem for them. Now, the Bank of England responded in a very interesting way. It inserted an extra article, yep. Article 428F, compared with similar legislation introduced by the European Banking Authority, which is, if you like, the equivalent in the EU, and also covers Switzerland, incidentally. And this article basically says that you can act as a settlement agent so long as you run a balanced position. In other words, everything on one side, which, you know, sort of liabilities to customers, has got to exactly match out the stuff on the other side, you know, the what comes in, if you like, as assets on your bank balance sheet. Now, this what this does, and this is part one of 428F, is it allows the London Precious Metals Clearing Association, or Limited rather, to continue to act as the settlement engine for all the forward contracts in London. And the forward contracts basically all balance out, I mean, on a day-to-day basis. The reason that they needed to involve the EBA is because UBS is one of the shareholders in LAPMCL, and therefore they needed to get regulatory clearance to continue to act as a shareholder in this settlement engine, as it were, from the European Banking Association. So that, as I understand it, is now in process. Mm-hmm. I would expect the EBA to go along with it.
Probably. Right.
Yeah.
And that impacts UBS, as you said.
Yeah, absolutely. The other thing that we must note is paragraph 2,
right,
which applies to an institution's unencumbered physical stock of precious metals and customer deposit accounts in precious metals where all of the following conditions are met. A, the institution's unencumbered physical stock of each precious metal is used to cover customer deposit accounts in the same precious metal. And B, the institution is not exposed to liquidity or market risk resulting from either the sale of precious metals by the customer or the physical settlement of customer transactions in precious metals. In other words, you know, there mustn't be a counterparty risk involved anywhere in this process. And lastly, the precious metals assets and liabilities are on the balance sheet of the institution.
Alistair, hold on. Let me stop you there, because this is one of the most important points, I think, and I want to make sure everybody got this. I don't want people's eyes to gloss over at this point. There's the LPMCL. Okay. They need to continue clearing because you've still got all these forwards out there. But when you've got
a mixture of forwards and physical at the moment, it's almost, I mean, it's like 90% or even more forwards.
Right. Yeah. But now going forward, there's no way, as you said, it's physically impossible to have all of the unallocated in these forward accounts. There's just not that much gold there. As you said, it's even on just a back of the napkin type of calculation in your article, it's like 8,400 tons. Right. Yeah. And there's no 8,400 tons just laying around in London. I mean, they'd say, well, look at the LBMA, you know, look at the LBMA's vaults. Yeah. Well, what, 6,000 tons is the Bank of England, right? 1,500 tons is ETF gold. So it's not like that stuff is just there to be delivered out. So,
yeah, well, let me just add a little gloss to what you're saying. The physical liquidity in London, I would estimate to be less than 500 tons.
Right.
Now, the we're talking about daily settlements of about $30 billion. So this, right. you can see that, you know, this 500 tons, I mean, it's a sort of balancing figure, if you like, because every maturing unallocated position just matches off unless whoever has got a long position is standing for delivery. So that's the way the system works.
So here's the thing, Alistair. As you mentioned in your article, in paragraphs 2 and 3 of Article 428F, you say these are very important because, you know, these banks have been running these unallocated accounts for years, you know, and then they shift metal around on, you know, from one side of the vault floor to the other and that sort of thing. But to continue running unallocated accounts on a pooled basis, they've got to have going. This is still in there. They've got to have the physical metal to be able to physically deliver against all of their unallocated responsibilities and commitments. Otherwise, there's a financial penalty. Am I summing that up right?
You're summing it up absolutely right. Can I just take it a little bit further?
Please.
Because, in effect, before this came in, You could go to a bullion bank and say, right, I want to deposit some gold in your vault. I want you to hold this in custody for me. What are you going to charge? Now, the cost of, you know, to a very large customer would be in the region of 8 to 10 basis points for storing that gold. That would be stored in the bank's vault and insured. So that is something that is already going on, and mm-hmm. that is part of the, you know, 9,000 tons, which is routinely reported by the LBMA.
Yep.
What we now have is an on-balance sheet equivalent of that, whereby under paragraph 2 of this article 428F, a bank can actually put what is in effect an allocated gold position onto its own balance sheet on a pooled basis. So according to this new rule, if you have unallocated gold positions or deposits, as it were, that must be backed by physical gold on the bank's balance sheet to match those deposits.
How about that?
If you don't do that, then you are going to find that in terms of managing your balance sheet, there is an extra cost to the whole operation. And the extra cost is likely to, I mean, it will certainly make it less profitable as far as the bank is concerned to run unallocated positions, unbalanced, or hedge, say, through the COMEX futures market, which amounts to the same thing as an unbalanced position in this sense. So you've now got these two ways of doing it. You can run a pooled account as long as it's physically backed, or you can continue to offer safe custody arrangements off balance sheet. So what we're now doing, in effect, is we're strangling the old forward delivery market and encouraging bullion banks either to get the hell out of it, or alternatively, if they want to continue to offer a service to customers in precious metals, then they must have the precious metals on their balance sheet. Now, this is going to come in at the end of this year. Technically, it's January the 2nd, because January the 1st is a public holiday. So January the 2nd, banks are now going to have to comply with these new rules. Now, they can continue to trade in derivatives, but there will be a financial penalty. And I think what will happen is that the Treasury departments of banks, you know, if they're traders, let's say the trader on the bullion desk turns around and says, well, I'd like to continue to have $100 million to play with, I think what they will do is they will say, well, the hurdle rate before was, say, 6%. The hurdle rate this time has got to go up to 10%, because I've got penalties, if you like, mm-hmm. in terms of managing my balance sheet. Through your big, I've got penalties from your activities. So you can see how it needn't necessarily stop, but it's going to become progressively less likely that banks are going to continue in this business. And incidentally, the whole objective of Basel III is to contain the risks of banks running uneven positions in derivatives, particularly in derivatives, because you may remember, going back to the Lehman failure, that the level of derivatives, I mean, was just crazy. We were talking about something like $700 trillion worth. Now, what they've done since then is they've brought in rules which allow you, where you've, let's say, I mean, particularly in something like the credit default swaps, you might have 150 contracts with one counterparty, and you've got 100 contracts for that same counterparty going the other way. You can enter into a written agreement with that counterparty to put them all together so that you have got a net position. But it has to be written. And quite a lot of the rules are about the treatment of those net positions, netting these derivatives. But even after all that, we're still looking at something like 500, 600 trillion of derivatives mm-hmm. outstanding. I mean, mm-hmm. this is a massive problem. And when you think that this is gearing, because the value of those derivatives on the bank's balance sheets is about 15 trillion. So you can see that the gearing is some horrendous. It's over 60 times. And that's on top of bank balance sheets, which, if you look at the European Union, their banks' balance sheets are already geared asset to equity up to 30 times. I mean, this is pig on pork, which, you know, obviously is of great concern to the Bank of International Settlements, and particularly the Basel Committee that on banking regulation.
So, Alistair, it seems on the surface then that we're still rowing in the right direction, at least to me. Yeah, I tell the story often from about, I guess it was about a year ago, that Andrew Maguire told me about a meeting that he and that, I can't remember the guy who was the member of parliament that actually read into the official record the stuff about the manipulation of price and the risk the bullion banks are taking. And then that got them a meeting with a guy by the name of Andrew Bailey, who at the time was the head of the FCA in England, but is now the head of the Bank of England. And when they met with Bailey and told him about, you know, these basically open-ended risks that these bullion banks are taking by having all of this unallocated metal and all these derivative contracts they're trading, that if they're ever, anybody, you know, if they're ever forced to deliver against it, they didn't have the metal, which made for this huge risk. Hmm. And he was just like confounded. He was like, I can't believe this. It's been 12 years. We thought we were out from under, you know, all of this bank trading. And now you're telling, we can't cut another check. People won't stand for it. We can't cover all their losses again. So it sounds to me like, even though this felt like a, you know, a kick in the stomach, we're still moving in the direction of the regulators saying, okay, look, if you want to, you know, run these unallocated accounts, whatever, fine, but you're going to do them on a fully back pooled basis if you are, so that if everybody shows up at once, like I always talk about with the car example, as long as only one person shows up for the car, the other 99 owners don't care. But if all 100 show up at once, then you got a problem. If what they're essentially trying to do, at least as it pertains to gold, is level that out, so that if all 100 do show up at once, if you're going to play that game, you've got to have the metal to provide to all 100 people if they show up at once. Would that be a fair way to assess paragraph 2 and 3?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. It is. I mean, I think the point that you were repeating about Andrew Bailey, you know, saying, you know, we can't let this happen again, I think it actually gets to the nub of the problem. And that is that central bankers know that they've got this problem, but there's nothing that they can actually do about it individually.
Yeah.
And this is why Basel III is so important, because it effectively levels the playing field, if you like, across different jurisdictions when it comes to putting in regulations. And I mean, it's quite clear to me that, you know, the LBMA, you know, have denied that that unallocated gold is a derivative, and then in their immediate response to the PRA's new rule book, which is incidentally not final but is as close to final as you'll ever get, they've effectively turned around and said, the situation over derivatives is quite favourable. You know, they claim that gross derivative liabilities attract a 5%. Required stable funding factor. But I mean, that's bizarre.
That makes no sense.
If that was true, physical gold would be rated substantially riskier than its derivatives, for goodness sake.
Ridiculous.
I mean, you know, their reading of it, it seems to me, is, I mean, I could be cynical and say self-serving, but, you know, there's so many contradictions in their approach to this, but it will get ironed out. I mean, I think the great takeaway from Basel III is the one that you mentioned, and that is that, you know, gradually they're pushing the banking system and the financial system away from this sort of massive derivative situation towards something which is less risky. And I think there's another consideration in this, and that is that the explosion in particularly gold derivatives and futures was really effectively sanctioned by the American government in the wake of the Nixon shock,
right?
Because what they wanted to do was to see artificial supply created to absorb any demand for physical metal.
Yep.
And I think we've moved on from those days. And I think if you talk to someone like Jay Powell, even if you talk to him off the record, confidentially, privately, whatever, you probably find he will say, well, look, you know, all that's in the past now. We don't care about it so much. It's not, you know, I mean, OK, we've got a note on our balance sheet which says that we've got 8,170 odd tons guaranteed by the U.S. Treasury. But, you know, beyond that, I mean, really, we got no interest in it. And I think that's generally true. But outside America, of course, there is another situation, and that is that China has more or less cornered the physical gold market.
Mm-hmm.
which makes it important for Britain, I think, to try and evolve away from derivatives to becoming, if you like, the other major physical center, physical dealing center, if you like, to, as an offset for geopolitical reasons against the Chinese. And not only that, but I mean, it's a very valuable activity in London. And I think if you can retain that and retain it on a more stable basis, then surely that's, you know, a big net plus positive. And I think that's probably the way the Bank of England looks at it.
And so in the end, Alistair, I felt this way when I saw this 12 days ago. Oh, man, this is just the biz capitulating, and it's just going to be business as usual. You know, these bankers are all chummy, you know. And, but that's not really what this is. This is still a concrete step in the right direction, because they're going to be allowed to keep, you know, the trading center and the trading hub, but no longer, I shouldn't say that. There's now a disincentive to keep doing it the way they've always done it through these financial penalties. If you want to keep doing it that way, okay. But a better way to do it is to actually physically back all of these obligations that you've created. And the other thing, Alistair, I want to just draw back to before we begin to wrap up, is this notion that you said that they want, that the LBMA wants to consider a forward contract as an allocated thing, not a derivative. But is there precedent within the biz to say, what are you, crazy? Of course it's a derivative. I mean, when will we get some clarification on that?
Well, I mean, presumably it'll come in due course. I don't think there'll be an announcement as such, but I think you'll just find that quietly there'll be sort of backpedaling by the LBMA.
Okay.
Not actually mentioning anything. Because, I mean, from here, the way it works is that the LBMA will be holding meetings with the PRA, and you know, they will be told the facts of life, and they may, I suppose, get some leeway on the way it is treated, but I don't think there's very much leeway. And to my mind, you know, this 428F article, I think, spells it out very, very clearly. This is the way you're going to do it, mate, sort of thing.
Yeah.
There is another aspect which I think we ought to bear in mind in terms of the big politics behind this. The Bank of International Settlements is hosting all the research, centralizing all the research with central bank digital currencies. Now, the point about central bank digital currencies is that they bypass the commercial banking system. So mm-hmm. What I'm seeing is that the importance of the banking system in the future is actually being downgraded by the central bank of the central banks on behalf of the central banks. So you can see, I think that, you know, we're probably at peak commercial banking.
Yeah.
You know, peak commercial bank banking, as it were. I mean, from here, I mean, I was actually looking at some figures. I mean, if you look at the American banking network, you've got about a short $16 trillion of bank credit on the H8, the Fed's H8 listing sheet. And of that, there's only about $2 trillion, which is actually lent out to business, you know, in the form of leases and loans. The rest of it is either government, agency debt, loans against property, consumer lending. What, I mean, out of nearly $16 trillion, you've only got $2.5 trillion lent out to businesses. I mean, you know, they're not in the business of financing Main Street anymore.
Right.
Main Street production. So, so if put yourself in the Fed's situation, you sort of think, I mean, apart from financing government, do we really need these guys? So you can see that attitudes, I think, in central banks are probably evolving in a way which is not yet quite obvious. But I read the runes and I detect, if you like, a sense of where it is going. And I think that what we're seeing in the precious metals markets under these new Basel rules is completely consistent with central banks downgrading the importance of commercial banks within their financial systems.
I like it. And I guess, in to sum up with this, I don't know. I don't want to. I don't want to have people think that I'm trying to put some kind of positive spin on it. But this Basel III and these new rules was not. They weren't just going to move the entire world. You know, that's been built up of unallocated accounts and futures and forwards and leases and promissory notes and everything else. You weren't just going to wipe all that out. You know, in one fell swoop. If anything, though. You know, if you think of Basel III as being an effort that was begun a dozen years ago in the aftermath of the financial crisis to force a deleveraging, not just in gold and silver, but I mean across the whole banking operations and all of their derivatives, then this is still a step in the right direction, especially as it pertains to getting. We're not driving a brand new physically backed, you know, all physical gold and silver price, but at least we're taking. The lion's share, perhaps, of those derivatives, and forcing the banks that operate in those markets to back them with physical metals, rather than just, you know, hey, it's just all this paper, you know, and we just, you know, net it all out and everything. You know what I'm saying? Are we at least, is that a good way to sum it up? We're at least moving in the right direction?
Yeah, absolutely. I would agree with that entirely. I mean, it does raise other questions, which I'll mention one in particular. Okay. We won't go down the rabbit hole, but... Frank Veneroso back in 2002 said that he'd worked out that there was anything between 10,000 and 15,000 tons of gold leased by central banks mm-hmm. into the system, mm-hmm. which had just disappeared. Question, what's the leasing and swap situation from central banks at the moment?
Now, yeah.
I mean, and when you bear in mind that the IMF pronounced about how central banks should account for this, that if they were owed physical gold, then they could include it in their accounts as actually being there. So, you know, the fact that you lease gold, you retain possession of it. The fact that you haven't actually got possession of it is another matter.
Right.
But you can account for it as if you do have possession of it. So, you know, what is the leasing situation, leasing and swap situation amongst the central banks, and not only just between central banks, but also between central banks and the commercial banks and the market? That is going to be something which is going to be very interesting to try and get a handle on as to how that is going to evolve.
Yeah. Alistair, extraordinarily helpful, and it's good to know that you are on the case, keeping track of all this in the months ahead. I'll still be curious to see how much position unwinding impacts price, but also maybe physical acquisition impacts price over the remainder of 2022, and I guess we'll have to see how that goes. But man, like I said, I really, really appreciate you explaining all this to us so that we all have a better handle on what all this meant from 2 weeks ago. Thank you. I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
And everybody, hopefully you enjoyed listening to this, and hopefully this cleared it up. And Alistair, I would imagine as things change, we'll hear from you again, I hope.
I look forward to being invited.
Like you need an invitation. Oh, my friend. Anyway, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. And thank you, everybody, for listening. We'll have another Thursday conversation for you next week.